Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I love the fact that you've got Japanese tattoos that you got whilst you were pissed. I think that's...
Yeah. Oh, I was in my younger days.
René Dupree, how are we doing?
Glad to be alive.
Yeah, I get that. Because am I right in thinking that for you guys, you're in New Brunswick, aren't you, René?
Yes, sir.
So we're only, what, a couple of days away now, really, from restrictions being lifted properly, or at least easing, am I right?
Well, I mean, we got to wear masks everywhere. But, I mean, that's the only restriction that I see. But then again, I don't leave the house very much.
That's fair enough.
I go to the gym. My wife does all the grocery shopping. So then that I'm pretty much a hermit.
Would you say you were a hermit before lockdown, or has lockdown just encouraged you to become a hermit?
Before this pandemic, I was traveling 10 to 15 countries a year all over the world, right?
You were in Japan, I think, before all this stuff caught fire. You were in, Japan during it as well, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But with the world sort of getting back to normal, aside from wrestling, what very normal things have you missed doing?
That's all I do.
Just
I
wrestling.
I literally have no life. It's wrestling. That's it.
But the traveling as well, I imagine it's, as you say, living on the road all the time to suddenly being stuck at home. It's been quite a change of the pace for you.
Yeah.
It was in lockdown that you started Café de René. This is the YouTube channel. We'll start talking about it straight away. I think when it comes to the channel, what was the inspiration behind you going, I'm ready to start sort of telling some stories and catching up with some old friends?
Boredom.
That's
it. No, I was, people kept messaging me. Did I freeze there? Okay, there. People kept messaging me to do their YouTube shows, right? So I was like, okay, so something to do. And then I met James and he's like, would you like to start your own? And I was like, oh, fuck, I got nothing else to do. So we just started and then, gradually built from there. Now I've got two shows a week. I bring a guest on every week on Mondays. And then we do a topics video on Thursdays. And one's dropping. Well, when does this air?
This is going out on Wednesday, the 2nd of March.
Oh, shit. Okay, well, on Thursdays, we do a topic. So we do two shows a week. And yeah, trying to grow it, you know.
Have you found that you look at wrestling in a different way now that you're sat at home consuming it more?
I don't watch it on television.
No?
I haven't watched it on television in 16 years. No, I can't. I can't watch American products.
Hmm.
Like, I watch the odd match. Like, give me a Serena Deeb match, I can watch that. Give me a Bryan Danielson match, I can watch that. Or a Minoru Suzuki match, I can watch that. But to sit and watch a bunch of zombies eating on a fucking corpse, or I can't do it.
No, you've said previously that you can't, when you've spoke about, like, because when you do these interviews, quite often they'll go, when are you going back to WWE? When are you doing that? And they always, we're not doing that, by the way, there's no reason to do that. But a lot of the time it's the case of, I think I heard you chatting with Chris Van Vliet and you said, well, I can't fake that I'm having a good time.
Right. No, it has to be genuine.
You know? Yeah. And
in Japan, I can do that because they wrestle, right?
There's a lot of love for Japan, yeah. And Japan has a lot of love back to you. So the podcast is started. There's two a week. The YouTube channel's flourishing as well. Away from doing that, what other things have kept you sane during like the last 18 months of lockdown stupidity?
The weight room.
Yeah.
Yeah. Netflix.
What was the last thing you watched? No, you laugh, but we've all been there. It's a shared experience. Right. What was the last thing you binged on Netflix, Renee?
Well, Salt Park is back.
Yeah.
So that's I didn't watch it last night, but tonight we'll be watching the episode. A lot of documentaries. I actually have Netflix and I have it was Amazon Prime.
Mm.
So we watched the documentary on Von Dutch. That was pretty interesting.
Nice.
Watching lots of documentaries on different things. I'm into like a lot of the subjects I use on Cafe de Renee, my YouTube channel, is I talk to a lot of guys that had substance abuse problems, right? Because mm-hmm. right now, I don't know how it is over in the UK, but North America, there's this thing called fentanyl that's creeping up. And it's like a epidemic, man. It's killing people. You know,
one of the things that you said is about how the era that you were involved in WWE, there was so much of that going on. You saw it happening all around you.
Yeah.
So it's something that's very close to your heart. And I know you've had guests on to talk about the drug issue. So taking time away to look at it more is incredibly important, I think. And I think it's knowledge. Do you feel like... we're getting quite deep quite quick. This is exciting. Do you feel that compared to the American wrestling scene, which you've left for a while now, you've been away for a while and you've had no reason to go back into the States to wrestle, but do you think that the scene is any cleaner than it was than when you left?
On the outside looking in, it looks that way, but I'm not there.
Right.
Right. And don't forget, there's always that shield of secrecy. Like, for example, you're a fan, right?
Mm-hmm.
You had no idea about the level of drug consumption back in the early 2000s.
No, we were there was obviously you hear reports and stuff, but again, we're not there. We can't see it all go down. You can only see the awful aftermath of it.
That's it. So I don't know because I'm not there. And when you're in that system, it's like you don't want to be a whistleblower. You don't want to be a stooge. So, you know, but the thing is, on the outside looking in, do they take better care of their wrestlers as far as if they're injured? Mm. And you know what I mean? It looks that way. So that's great. Because back then, they didn't. You know, you were paranoid. You were worried about losing your spot. I've seen guys fuck up their shoulder. Excuse my language.
No, you can swear. It's fine. It's all good.
Okay. Mess up their shoulders or their knees and then get released. Right.
You said something similar about Andrew Martin.
Yeah.
In a similar situation.
His neck, they fired him.
It's a relief, at least then, at least as you say, from what you can tell, that there is some change there, at least some mm-hmm. more duty of care, which there always should, which there should have been in the first place, but there's always should have been. We're going to look back, but we're going to look back in hopefully a bit more of a positive light, because I've asked you, Renee, to have a think about three wrestling matches that you would watch if you were metaphorically on a desert island. Because the one thing that we need after 18 months of being locked inside like a hermit is to be on a desert island somewhere.
Right.
That seems the most appropriate way to go. So throughout the course of our chat today, we're going to go one by one and pick out your three matches. So match number one, Renee, what would you like?
My all-time favorite match, the match that every young student should watch, the basis of what professional wrestling should be, Buddy Rogers versus Pat O'Connor, 1963, Comiskey Park, Chicago.
So when do you remember seeing that one for the very first time?
About 12 or 13 years old.
So your dad, and for those who don't know, like your dad was a major name.
Yeah.
Part of the industry. Was it your dad that showed you this match?
Yeah. He said, basically, if you want to learn how to wrestle, this is like the gauge, the blueprint of what a good guy, bad guy, you know what I mean? Buddy Rogers was the all-time greatest ever, in my opinion.
With... obviously your dad, Emile Dupree, who did so much in the wrestling world. He traveled all over the world. He wrestled guys like Killer Kowalski, wrestled guys like Bull Curry, Dick the Bruiser, Dusty Rhodes. Was it always going to be wrestling for you, do you think?
I don't think he wanted it that way, but he had no choice because I was hooked. You know what I mean? I had the bug. I would sit in front of, because we had a copy of WrestleMania 1, right? And I was only like 4 or 5 years old, but I would sit in front of the TV because back then it was VCR. Do you remember those?
I do indeed. I'm flattered that you think I look young enough to not remember VCRs. I will take that as a great compliment.
Right. So, the English drink their tea every day, so it's very healthy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, I'd sit in front of the VCR and I'd watch WrestleMania 1. And then as soon as it was done, I'd rewind the tape and watch it. I had severe OCD from a young age. So they had to take the tape away from me because I was watching it too much. I was obsessed over it. So I think he knew, he could see that, okay, there's no way my kid's obsessed with it. So, and then like for him too, like he had gotten out of it in 1990, right? Because he had lost his television and the promotion went under. But once you're in this business, it's the ultimate drug. It's the ultimate, it's in your blood. You can't get rid of it, right?
When you say you were diagnosed with OCD at a young age, you're one of quite a big family. Like, did your other siblings have OCD as well? Was there any?
There's a lot of mental health in my family. Yeah.
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 So what age were you? Did you say you were when you were diagnosed with OCD?
Never really diagnosed, but I know I have it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like addiction issues started with sugar. You understand? Like food is an addiction, right? Gambling is an addiction. Pornography can addiction. Sex, drugs, there's all kinds of addictions. Exercise. When you're exercising 4 or 5 hours a day, you know you have an issue, right? It's not normal, right? And there's a lot of that in entertainment in general, I've noticed. Not just like with wrestlers, but like comedians, actors, musicians. There's a lot of OCD.
So with yourself then, it was rewinding, watching WrestleMania 1 over and over and over again. But you were a big eater as well. I know you said previously that, was it you having your tonsils out that led you to...
That's it.
...increasing your
the tonsils and hitting puberty.
It's a heady combination.
Right. So, like, I remember from ages 12 to 13, I shot up about 4 inches in height. And I put on about 30 pounds in the summer. It was insane. But, like, I was a skinny kid, but all my family, both my mother and father's side, are big boned, muscular people, right? So I just had a growth spur. But then you combine that with OCD and, you know, studying nutrition, you know, and then eating properly. Like, for example, OCD to the point where, okay, if I have to eat every 2.5 hours, I'd sit by and wait till, say I eat at 7:30, I would sit, wait till 10 o'clock on the dot to eat again. That obsessed, yeah.
Has that changed as you've got older?
Yes, thank God. I mean, I'll still eat my 5 or 6 meals a day. I'll still get my workouts in, but I'm not sitting, you know, weighing every little gram of protein and trying to like measure every little cup of fucking, excuse my language, brown rice or yams or, you know what I mean? I'll just go judge, okay, that looks about right.
It just seems like when, you know, somebody who was the growth spurt, you got bigger, you got taller, and, you know, your dad is a big name in the business. Like genetically and metaphorically, you were destined for it almost. I know your dad said that he didn't want you in the business. What lengths did your dad go to try and talk you out of it, if he did?
Oh, he went in like, you remember video stores? We could rent videos.
I do remember videos. Again, flattered. This is the best. I'm flattered that you think I don't remember them. I'm delighted.
Well, he wouldn't let me rent like WWF videotapes.
Oh, right. So you'd ask them and he'd just go, no, absolutely not.
But I have to hide it from him. Oh, yeah.
Did he ever find you watching them?
Yes. Yeah. At first there'd be physical beatings.
Right.
It was that bad. Yeah. The bitterness towards WWF was that bad. Because I mean, he took the business away, right?
Mm.
I mean, think about it. You run a business and you're making high six figures a year, and that's taken away from you.
Yeah.
It's common. It's, you know, human nature, right?
So how did it go then from you getting a hiding for watching a wrestling show behind your dad's back to your dad going, okay, here's Gene Kanitsky and Pat O'Connor? Like, how did that eventually...
Buddy Rogers, Pat O'Connor.
Apologies, Buddy Rogers, Pat O'Connor. How did it go? That's a whole different match. How did it go from Buddy Rogers, Pat O'Connor, to your dad going, here's Rogers and Pat O'Connor? Watch that.
Well, finally, when I was 12, 13, he realized... I can't help it. He's hooked, you know? So here, and then at 13, he started promoting again. And then at 14, I got in the ring.
So you had your first wrestling match at the age of 14 years old. So, out of interest, just I don't know how well you remember, but like, what was the average age of that locker room that you worked that first wrestling match with?
25, 30.
We
even had some 50-year-olds.
What was the vibe the temperature around that night then, when, you know, you're the son of a legend, you're still a teenager and you're wrestling first match on his show?
The fact that my dad was the owner helped, obviously. Yeah. You know, I have a lot of advantages that way. But I was forced to grow up a lot faster. Understand?
Mm.
Yeah. So my childhood was a lot different than most.
In what way?
I was forced to grow up a lot faster. What most 19, 20, 25-year-old men do when they're out with the other boys. Well, I did that at a very young age, you understand?
Mm-hmm.
And I looked a lot older, so I could get into bars and strip clubs. And, you understand?
I'm with you. Yeah. Did you have friends, like, did you have other circles of friends outside of wrestling that were more your age?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. My father's territory was seasonal, right? It was the spring, summer, and sometimes into the fall. But wintertime, there's no wrestling because all the hockey arenas are closed or filled with ice. So there's nowhere to run wrestling, right? So that was kind of a mind screw too, because you go from the wrestling world with adults, then you have to go back to high school with kids your own age. Different difference in mentality, right? Yeah.
So how did that manifest itself then? Because you spent a season with guys much older than you. You're going to strip clubs, you're drinking, you're doing whatever. And then you're back at school and you must have felt like a fish out of water.
Yeah, definitely a bad influence.
On
the other kids. Because I found this new lifestyle that it's a lot more fun than what most teenage boys do, right? But I was also a loner. Because I couldn't relate to anybody. I had a few, like two or three friends that were hardcore wrestling fans, right? Because that I was hooked, right? And out of the whole school, I was the only guy who lifted weights and actually decided to compete in bodybuilding, right?
So with the bodybuilding thing as well, because again, it's funny how your dad was so against steering you towards that path, but like it's such a similar path that you trod. You know, you started young. Your dad did bodybuilding as well, and people went, "Hey, you should do the wrestling thing," and then you were doing the bodybuilding thing as well. And you know, just to spin on the story a little bit, so you started wrestling at 14 years old. You would end up getting signed by WWE, and What was the reaction at home to that, considering how angry your dad was, and rightly so, towards the WWF at the time? Like, how did your dad react to that?
I think the reason he didn't want me in it, because the business had totally changed. See, when he got in it, there was like 30 or 40 different places you could go and wrestle in the territory system, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot more opportunities, as opposed to back in the 90s, there was only the WWF, because WCW had just got shit bought out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because I remember when I was 15, okay, remember Paul Orndorff?
I do, Mr. Wonderful.
Well, he was an agent for WCW, and he had came down to the territory Grand Prix to scout. And when he see me, he was like, okay, well, once he graduates, turns 18, we'll bring him to WCW. Right. But by 2001, they had shut down. Right. Mm-hmm. So I sent my, a lot of the guys, I don't want to mention names, Cody Rhodes. I don't want to mention any names, Randy Orton. I don't want to mention any names, Natty Neidhart. They all got hired strictly because of who their parents were. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't in that case at all because my father had no connections there. Right. So I sent a resume just like everybody else, did a tryout match just like everybody else, a tryout camp. But at 18, when you're 6'3", 255 pounds, in just one, a Mr. Canada bodybuilding championship, and you know how much Vince loves bodies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So...
A no-brainer. It was a no-brainer. They signed you up once you showed you what you could do.
Yeah.
To cross over again, like from so your dad, your first match that you chose, it was Buddy Rogers in action, and again, like that crossover with your dad who said like this is how you have a wrestling match, Buddy Rogers, Pat O'Connor, this is a match, and then you go into the WWE system, which is so different. And it is so much more based around, you're putting on an entertainment piece, you're putting on a theatre production. And then I apologize, I've gone.
Not in OVW.
Right, of
course. OVW, Rip Rogers was the coach, and it was an old school feel.
Mm.
Rip Rogers, where do you think he got his name?
From your dad?
Buddy.
Oh, Buddy Rogers. Oh, Gene Kaniski. No, that's a joke. Buddy Rogers, of course. But there was, so who was running OVW at the time that you were there? Was it Cornette?
Cornette did TVs. Hmm. Right. Danny Davis ran the day-to-day operations. And Rip Rogers was the coach.
So
Rip Rogers was a great coach.
How different was it to go from sort of being under your dad's tutelage to under Rip Rogers in OVW? How different was that?
You have to understand, wrestling for my dad, we were in front of a live crowd every night doing weekly talents. When I was 15, we did May 1st till September 7th, 7 nights a week, double shots on Sunday without a day off. So that's what, 128 days in a row, but 150 matches, something like that. Or I would wrestle twice a night. I would go in the second match, then we'd go into a battle royal at the end or a six-man tag. So in one summer, I got 300 matches. Right, if you count it, right?
That's quick maths. It's about 300 matches.
Right. Isn't that crazy?
It's like the you've come and you've done your fair share of stuff over here in the UK as well, but it's a bit like over here. There's the camp shows, there's the Butlin shows, where they are seasonal.
I did that.
You did the Butlin's run. It's good, isn't it?
Right.
I do. What I love about that is everybody that we've spoke to, we've had a few guys on here who did the Butlin shows, and the one thing that comes across whenever you talk about them is it really drills into you just the fundamentals, because it's a non-wrestling crowd a lot of the time. So you've got to ramp up being a bad guy, ramp up being a good guy, get the simple bits right, and they'll pop every time. Then was that the same? Was that the experience that you had as well?
I did that post WWF.
Oh, that was the WWE, fun.
Excuse me, Madison Square Garden, to working for Brian Dixon doing the Butlins run, setting up the ring, tearing it down. Ugh.
To go from that, I mean, for you, because I know you requested your release from WWE,
yes.
So I can imagine that going into something like that felt like a massive refresh.
Well, it was a massive fucking refresh, especially with the paycheck.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Right?
Brian Dixon pays slightly less.
Let's just say a lot of promoters don't tell the truth all the time.
No!
Oh.
What? They're all so honest!
Yeah, right. Okay.
As I said to the one promoter that I think I chased money for a year, they're all so honest all the time.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, jeez.
But so yeah, so it's so the shows that you ran, the seasonal shows that you ran, very different to what you did in OVW, which was a different schedule and a very different pace.
We learned television.
There is that too.
That was TV. Then we do the little spot shows in Indiana in front of 50, 60 people. Yeah. But the TV was the key. Camera calls and interviews and, you know what I mean?
How did you find all that?
Well, it was a different territory. Every time you go to a different territory, it's exciting. Different atmosphere. But it's like anything else. It gets old, right? Mm. And you want something new.
And you got something new when you got moved upwards to WWE. Before we get into that, let's get to your second wrestling match for your Desert Island. So we've had Buddy Rogers, Pat O'Connor. What would you like your second one to be, Renee?
Any match involving Dynamite Kid and Tiger Mask.
Ah, brilliant. I love when these come up. Can you remember the first time you saw Dynamite Kid and Tiger Mask and what your reaction was?
Well, first time I seen Dynamite Kid is when he worked for my dad.
Yeah?
I got his ring jacket at my parents' house.
Ha! Wow, that's a bit of history. How did you come to get it? How did you come to own it?
He gave it to me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you ask him or did he just go, "Here you go"?
No, I just saw me hanging around the matches, and because I remember seeing him on WWF television, right?
Mm.
So for me, I was like, you know, just a little kid, and you know, here you go, kid. He smoked, right? He had no teeth.
Yeah. He lived a lifestyle. He drove it like he stole it for 20 odd years, did Dynamite Kid.
Yeah. Well, a lot of guys did. You know. So what is the first time Tiger Mask, Dynamite Kid, first time? I can't remember. It must have been my dad's tapes. You have to understand, my dad was a promoter, so we would always get tapes sent to our house. There'd always be guys, wrestlers from all over the world sending tapes. And a lot of times he didn't. This is even after he quit promoting. We still get tapes. He didn't, after 1990, he didn't care. He was so sick with wrestling, right? But we still get the tapes. He'd throw it on the counter. I'd go watch it. So I'd be watching all types of different wrestling. A lot of good stuff. A lot of really crappy wrestling too, right?
Is there somebody on one of these tapes? I'm keen to know. So your dad gets sent all these tapes and he got, as you say, 1999, he got fed up with it. So you started watching these tapes. Is there anybody that you saw on these tapes that caught your eye that then went on to be a big deal in wrestling?
Want to hear a story?
I would love a story, Renee.
So my dad started promoting back, opened up in 1997, right? Mm-hmm. My dad got this package from Toronto. The first thing he would do is look at the 8x10. Blonde haired kid. He's not very big. Here, Renee, go put on this tape, see what he can do. I'll never forget, he was doing nip ups. At the time, it was like, you know, like Hurricane Ranas, all that stuff. At that time, it was very unique, right? And it was a video package, My Wave by Soundgarden. That song?
Mm-hmm.
I said, Dad, you got to bring this guy in. Do you want to know who he was?
Go on.
Christian Cage.
Nice. That's great. Does Christian know that story? Have you? Because obviously you told
him. You'll know now.
You'll know now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Lots has been said about your run in WWE, and you know, we don't want to tread the ground too much more than we have. One thing I was keen to ask about was the one thing that stuck out as you sort of found your feet in WWE, sort of became away from La Resistance and became your own man. Taz's commentary during your matches was always a great joy. Where obviously you perfected a move called the French Tickler, which Taz took great delight in shouting about on commentary. Were you aware of the fun that Taz was having around all of that and your matches? Did you guys talk about it?
Dude, would you believe, like, after a 4-day week, like, I was so tired. Mm. I would watch my matches sometimes on mute. I'd even listen to the commentary.
Fair enough.
Like, seriously, dude, like, especially when you go on these like European tours, like England, we go for 10, 12, 14 days. Dude, you didn't even want to watch wrestling anymore. Like me, you know, when you get done, you just want to go home, you want to rest, and you got to pack up to go back on the road. Now and then I catch the wrestling matches or you're watching and catering, but a lot of times I even listen to the commentary. Now I do, if I go watch my stuff back.
Mm. I was gonna say, because you started singing the song under your breath.
Yeah.
So you heard it.
I heard it, yeah. Don't forget, I've been gone there for what, 15 years?
It's been a while.
Yeah, been a long time.
A lot of people don't know that you were re-signed in 2011.
Yes, sir.
And then nothing happened. Like, are you able to shed any light on sort of that sort of phantom re-signing that you had?
Well, actually, today we're dropping this. Well, this airs on March 2nd. Well, today there's a Vince McMahon episode on my Cafe de Rene podcast.
Okay. So when people listen to this, it'll already be there.
So I go deep into detail about that signing. Mm. But let's just say I felt like I was lied to. I was told something. But then again, I've never since then, or since I left the WWE, actually showed up to a show. I've never done that. So maybe one day I should show up and say, hey, Vince, where's that contract? Did it get lost in the mail?
He might say, well, thank God you're here, pal. I've been waiting for ages. What time'd you call this?
Yes, the briefcase.
I've been carrying it all these years. It's like the Ark of the Covenant. So I don't want to. If people want to find that story, let's throw them over to Cafe de Rene rather than giving away the detail here. But what I would like to, again, if the answer is coming up in the podcast, then we'll send them that way again. Obviously, there must have been conversations when the re-signing was taking place, this phantom re-signing that never happened. And I know that you've said in previous interviews that there's been a few conversations about potential returns to WWE. Can you shed any light on what capacity that would have, could have been in? Like, in terms of what you might have been doing, where you might have been assigned to, anything like that?
I was just told that we're going to bring you back on top, Renee.
We all know who that is.
Yeah, I don't have to say the name. You guys know.
Absolutely.
That's what I was told. But then again, promoters and people in administration tend to fib. They fib a little bit.
They do fib a little bit.
Yes.
I can, and there's a lot of people who will be watching sort of what WWE does now, and there is that sort of poison chalice about it, because people are, like yourself, told, hey, come in, we're gonna make you a star, and then just unceremoniously within a few months, yeah, we're budget cuts, we're letting you go. You said that Japan made you fall back in love with wrestling.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
When did you realize that you loved wrestling again after you left WWE?
My first All Japan tour. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What was it on that tour? Was there something that happened, a particular moment on that tour that the eureka moment?
I met, you know, King Curtis?
I do, yeah.
Well, King Curtis has a nephew named Taiyo Kea. He's very famous in All Japan Pro Wrestling. And hanging out with him, man, made me love wrestling again. Just being on tour and just joking around. Because in WWF at that time when I was there, was a lot of paranoia, a lot of hazing, a lot of senior members of the roster paranoid about losing their spot. So a lot of backstabbing. And that takes the fun out of it, man. Like, you're there to have, you know, but when you realize it's a business and you realize that you can, like you said, you can get fired like that and you're out the door like that. And it doesn't matter if you sign a 3-year contract, 5-year contract. There's a little clause in that contract where it says we can fire anytime for anything, for any reason, you know? So... Especially being a foreigner.
Because this is the issue that you had, that, you know, because being from Canada, the moment you're gone from WWE, then that's a whole lot of visa paperwork that you've got to deal with.
That's it. Can't work anywhere else.
You haven't wrestled in the States for a long time now. And is that now, is obviously that's deliberate. But is that more a preference now that you'd rather just wrestle anywhere but in America?
Because I don't like the American style. I don't like what I see on American television. You understand?
That's fair. That's fair. Is that across the board? Are we talking WWE, AEW, Impact?
I watched a few AEW matches, like my friends, like Serena Deeb, Minoru Suzuki. I can watch that, but... when I see this spot fest, I mean, if people like it, but that's not my style. Understand? I'd have to work with a heavyweight if I went there, right? Mm-hmm. Who am I going to work with? Luchasaurus?
Yeah.
Who am I going to work with? Wardlow? Right?
Your options are limited.
My options are limited. Because I'm not going to do a Young Bucks match. Right? I'd have to be a base. Just take all their shit. I could do it. But
there's more options for you doing stuff. I know you've done All Japan, you've done Wrestle One, you've been a big part of Pro Wrestling Noah as of late as well. So you've kind of got more people there that you can be evenly, easily matched up with.
Oh yeah. And it's the style I like. It's a hard hitting style. It's a reality based style. Plus, again, I'm independent. The exposure I get from there, for example, when I won the Global Tag League, NOAH Global Tag League, and within 1 week, I had 12 different offers.
Okay. So where were those offers from, can you say?
New Zealand, Singapore, Australia, Italy, a few places in the States, and other European countries that, like Poland that I've never been to.
How many of those did you take up?
I couldn't because of the pandemic.
Oh God, yeah, of course.
You know how much money I lost because this freaking thing.
But is the it's so you were getting them because you've been doing stuff in NOAH like in 2020, so you got a little bit of stuff, but it was you're very limited in terms of what you could do and where you could go. You've been, you know, especially in New Brunswick where there's been just like a really strong lockdown even to now. Right. Have you got stuff in place? Because as we're talking about this, like it looks as if things are about to ease up where you are. Have you got flights booked? Have you got dates in the diary for stuff coming soon?
Stay tuned.
Oh, are you flying to Japan or not, Renee? Can you tell us?
I don't know. Cafe de Renee on YouTube. Oh.
I tell you what, there's a story that I don't know whether you've shared it on Cafe de Rene, but I'd love you to share it here if you can. When people catch up with what you're doing now, you've got some cracking body art. And I love the fact that you've got Japanese tattoos that you got whilst you were pissed. And I think that's and I would like you to tell the story of how it started, what they are, and how it's going.
Well, I was in my younger days. I was 25. Yeah, it was my first All Japan tour. And I had the greatest time in the world. I got my first sponsor. And like a sponsor in Japan is like a guy, a fan with a lot of money, it takes you out. So he took us out to the Hard Rock, went to like all these fancy clubs, went to the badass strip club. I met some badass strippers. And I had so much fun on that tour. Then when I came home, I kept partying with my friends and I went to the dodgy tattoo parlor and I got the Japanese tattoo. Japan over here. And then I woke up the next morning. I was like, oh shit, this is real.
What, for those who don't know, what does it mean? What does the Japanese tattoo mean?
This means Japan.
Just means Japan.
Nippon, yeah, Japan.
And it's near your heart for that reason.
Yeah, but a lot of the senior Japanese, like Tenryu and Koi, they were pissed, actually. Like, what the fuck is a gaijin getting Japan written on, right?
Oh, really? There was some heat for it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because tattoos in Japan are still pretty forbidden, right? Mm. Yeah.
But, with I want to just dip back into it because like there'll be those people who will listen to this and they won't know the system there, but obviously you say that you went over to All Japan, you got a sponsor, so this is somebody that will basically subsidize your trip over there. Like, what's the process of getting a sponsor?
Different levels. Okay, you might get a sponsor, it'll take you out to eat. Okay, I had a sponsor that paid for my honeymoon.
Wow.
Terry Funk has a sponsor to fly him and his wife first class and pay his wage. Tens of thousands of dollars. Okay, there's different levels of sponsors.
But how did you go about getting one? Like,
they're fans. They like what you do in the ring. They'll come to you.
Mm. Right? Just reach out and just go, we'd like to pay for this. Bring you
the longer there. The longer you're there. Like, I've been there 15 years, right? So, enough. God bless them. Eventually, you know, there's some nights you're just stuck in your hotel room and you can only play on this thing for so long before you snap. You know, right?
I'm with you.
So then when they call you up, let's go out and you go out all night. I mean, it could be as simple as going out to we had one in one of the small towns, brought us out to a Filipino bar at night. You drink, you sing karaoke, you eat. Just something, you know, great.
What's a Rene Dupree karaoke classic?
Born to Be Wild.
Oh, great choice.
Yeah. Oh, Picture by Kid Rock and Sheryl Crow. That's a duet, though.
Oh, okay. So you'd need somebody else to do the Sheryl Crow bit.
That's it.
Nice. I like that. What's lovely is when you talk about Japan.
Yeah,
like you glow when you talk about it. There's so much love.
I love it there. Yeah.
Would you ever consider making a move permanently to Japan?
I did for 3 years.
Would you go back?
I don't think my wife wants to. My wife is Japanese, right?
Right, and she doesn't want to come. She doesn't fancy going back to Japan. She'd rather stay in Canada with yourself.
Once you live there, then you become accustomed to their culture. And it can be stressful. Mm. It can be stressful. For example, today, you were 5 minutes late for this interview.
Was I? I thought I was bang on time.
No. Well, on my clock, you were 5 minutes late. Oh. That's big, big problem in Japan.
Oh, wow. Well,
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, I apologize then. Right. I thought I was pressing the button bang on, but then my clock's probably wrong. I get it because you've just said that, and I feel stressed, and that's one thing.
No, but thanks to my time there, like now, like that's ingrained in my head. Mm. To always be on time because of, yeah. Because you know the saying, time is money?
Mm-hmm.
Time is money. That applies big time in Japan, right?
Amazing. I get that. How did you meet your wife?
At a club.
Was it singing pitcher by any chance?
We actually went out to karaoke that night. It was to a sponsor, right? We all went to a club that she was working at. And I was with Lance Cade, rest in peace. And I was so drunk. I was passed out like this. And I specifically learned one word, kawaii, which means pretty, right? Because that was going to be my big pickup line for the night. I was trying to pick up, right? So I was passed out and then I woke up and she was, you know, she's a pretty girl. And I just said, kawaii. And I passed back out. And apparently in my drunken stupor, I gave her my hotel. I don't know how she got my hotel room or how she got my number, but I had a press conference the next morning and she called me an hour before to wake me up. Yeah.
Oh.
Got married.
And how long was it from there till you got married?
Fuck, 6 months.
Nice. Wasted no time. When you know, you know.
Yeah, it's been 13 years now.
Amazing. And that's that, so it speaks more about why Japan's part of, is your home, why it's near your heart.
Yeah.
A multitude of reasons among that one. We've got one more match to pick for your desert island. So what would you like your third and final one to be, Renee?
Well, it's got to be Melina versus Alicia Fox.
There it is. Renee, everyone picks that match. Why is it every single time we do this? Everyone picks Melina and Alicia Fox. Honestly. Yeah, it's Melina and Alicia Fox again. Every time.
Actually, I know both those girls and they're really good people.
They took that whole thing on the chin. Right. Bless them.
In all seriousness,
yeah,
gotta be Savage Steamboat.
Ah, there it is. There it is. It's almost a Melina Alicia Fox. Almost.
Almost, but, not quite.
So this, and again, this is one that as tight, it's aged like a fine wine. This one has, because in the '80s, WrestleMania 3 was all about Hogan and Andre. Hogan and Andre. And as time has gone on, as the perception of the style in America, in the West, has changed. There's been more love for Savage and Steamboat as like a technical masterclass.
Right, right.
What's a moment from that match when we talk about it that appears in your head, that plays in your mind's eye? What's a moment from that match that you love?
Oh, fuck. Just Steamboat's arm drags. Mm. You know, the little spots. Steamboat skins the cat and he comes up and then fucking Savage clotheslines him over the top right away. And just the false finishes and the people getting with it, you know?
And is there something?
Was it Dave Hebner or Earl Hebner fucking blowing up trying to count the pins?
It's probably been Dave. But from that match, those are bits that you see when you're watching it, but say there was a young Rene Dupree who came to you and said, I want to get into this. And you know, the same way that your dad handed you Buddy Rogers' power collar or Jinkadisky, as I said earlier, either or, but you handed them Steamboat and Savage, what would you tell them to look out for in terms of true wrestling masterclass lessons to be had?
Their timing was impeccable. Psychology, you know, I always tried to throw arm drags like Steamboat. I never, when I was younger and lighter, I could, but just the timing is everything in wrestling, and their timing was impeccable during that. Mm. You know who was very OCD?
Savage, he was. There's stories that do the rounds of him like beat for beat planning out the matches. And working through that.
There's a guy who taught how to throw left hand. He's naturally right-handed, but taught to throw a baseball right-handed, left-handed, to make the team. St. Louis, I think it was St. Louis Cardinals or something.
Oh, really? Crazy?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. He taught how to throw himself left-handed.
Because he had to make.
Are you right-handed or left-handed?
I'm a lefty, sir.
Okay, so imagine teaching yourself to throw right.
As good as your left.
Think about that.
I'm crap at both, but immediately the thought of throwing with my non-dominant, like it's weird how you in your head you have to make extra steps to plan it when you don't with your left. But that's incredible commitment. That is.
Yeah.
So that is amazing commitment. Jeez. And stories like that and many others you can find on Café de René.
Café de René. That's it.
Two shows a week. I'd like you to, before we go, plug the channel once more, plug where people can find you and keep up to date with you. The floor is yours, sir.
Thank you, my friend. Well, yes, Café de René on YouTube. There's Café de René on Twitter, Café de René on Instagram. My personal stuff, just that doesn't matter. I'm here to promote Café de René on YouTube. Like, subscribe, share it if you can. And if you find me entertaining, sign up.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
For all the wrestling headlines in just 10 minutes, search Cultaholic Wrestling News on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.